Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna. Det här är podden för dig som är veterinär eller djursjukskötare och arbetar med häst. I Hästveterinärerna pratar vi om tillstånd och sjukdomar som kan drabba hästar. Men vi tar också upp andra ämnen som är relevanta för dig som arbetar med hästsjukvård. Den här podcasten görs av Böhringer Ingelheim och med den här podden vill vi ge något tillbaka till dig som arbetar med hästsjukvård på kliniken, i fält, dag som natt. Vi vill ta upp ämnen som är intressanta och relevanta för dig. Så om du har förslag på ämnen som du gärna vill höra om, eller om du har tips på en gäst som du skulle vilja att vi pratade med, så tveka inte att ta kontakt med oss. Kontaktuppgifterna hittar du i poddens beskrivning.
Welcome back to Hästveterinärerna or Hästdjurlägarna. I hope I pronounced that correctly for all our Danish listeners. And to our special podcast series on equine gastric ulcer syndrome. My name is Maria Willemsson and I am here with my colleague Louise Husted-Larsen. And this episode we want to devote to the actual condition, or rather conditions. Louise, why don't you start by just giving us a really short recap on what differentiates equine squamous gastric disease and equine glandular gastric disease?
Yeah, so we need to remember how the equine stomach is built. And we have two compartments in the equine stomach. So when the horse eats roughage, it chews it very well, produces a lot of saliva. It's only producing saliva as it chews. But then it has the little roughage ball coming down and into the top part of the stomach, which is the white part of the stomach. And that acts like a compartment that that stores the chewed roughage. And it's part of the big feed ball that's in the stomach that fills the glandular as well as the white part, the squamous part of the stomach. So the two compartments, the squamous and the glandular part, is divided into what we call margo plicatus, which is kind of a line between the two very distinct epithelia. So it's very easy to recognize in this when you see the stomach from the inside during gastroscopy. And if you move further down, you have the glandular mucosa, which is where your gastric acids are produced. So you have a lot of proton pumps down there that produces this hydrochloric acid at a continuous rate all the time in the horse, no matter whether it's eating or not. And it also produces a lot of mucus that protects the glandular mucosa from this acid. So it's a very delicate environment down there. So any imbalance between those two can cause ulcers in the glandular part of the stomach. And from there, the food will slowly get propelled out via small contractions into the duodenum. And from there on, your digestion will start through the small intestine and further down the large colon, where everything gets fermented and energy gets extracted. So that's how the stomach is working. It's essentially a big compartment for this roughage that needs to be prepared to go out into the small intestine.
And it's quite small also compared to the rest, volume-wise, of the gastrointestinal tract.
It's much smaller than in any other species. We usually say it's between 2-3% of the horse's body weight. So if you have a small pony next to you, 100 kilos, then your stomach will be 2-3 liters max. So that's very important to remember when you reflux a horse or something. Don't put 5 liters of fluid into a small 100-kilo pony, because that's going to be way too much. Mm. So usually you say that a big horse has around 15, 16 liters as a total volume. And that's very, very important to remember whenever you put anything in there, that you have technically in a well horse that's been eating a fair amount of roughage, that should be filled with at least 10, 12 liters of roughage in there, and then you only have a little bit extra room for whatever fluid or whatever you want to put inside the stomach. So you have to be careful of that.
So when it comes to treatment and management, what are the most important differences? If we start with treatment, What are the most important differences between these two conditions?
So most of the research up until now has been looking at squamous gastric ulcers. And that's because back in the day where we got the first gastroscopes, they were not long enough to get that far into the stomach. So you put the scopes in, and if you were lucky, you could sneak in and see the first squamous part of the stomach, but you could not get long enough down to really look at the glandular. So all the research that was produced back in the day was mainly on the squamous part. And that's why there's proportionately so much more literature on risk factors and how to treat. As the scopes grew longer, we got more and more knowledge about what's happening in the glandular part, and now we know that that's equally as big of a problem for the horses. And they're not necessarily caused by the same risk factors, so that also means that the treatments might be different. But most of the things we would say about squamous gastric ulcers would be okay to implement on the glandular part as well. But there are differences between the two that we're starting to get more and more information about. But we have to say that the glandular ulcers are still a little bit, we're still a little insecure exactly how to treat them and what the risk factors are. There are many, many studies coming out right now where we're looking at all kinds of different risk factors, and some become significant in some studies. And then when the next researchers are trying to prove the same point, they get different results. So nothing is clear-cut at the moment. In a later episode, we're going to look at some of the newest published studies on the glandular ulcers and their risk factors, and we can talk about what they find. But for now, there are not a lot of good hardcore treatment options for the glandular ulcers, except for whatever we're doing with the squamous as well. For the squamous ulcers, the mainstay have always been gastric acid inhibiting medication. So medications that will stop the acid production for a longer period of time. We do know that the ulcers need a rest for the acid of up to 4 weeks. With a once daily dose of some form of acid inhibiting medication. And most of these acid inhibiting medications, they do need to be given orally, but they're not absorbed orally and they're not giving you the effect directly in the stomach. They need to go all the way into the duodenum before they get absorbed and then act on their receptors, which is the proton pump. So they are proton pump inhibitors. So it's not a local effect. It needs to go all the way into the duodenum and gets absorbed. And that type of medication is also what we're using for the glandular ulcers. And then we add things depending on where it is.
Mm.
But there are none of the medications that will ever stand alone. Management changes and being the detective and looking into the different aspects of management around the horses are equally as important. So I think one of the most important lessons that people need to be aware of is that gastric ulcers are not treated by medication alone. It's only, let's say, 50%. If you forget about the last 50%, which is probably coming from management or other disease at the same time, then your treatment is very likely to fail.
Mm.
So you have to work with a holistic approach with these horses when you try to treat them.
Mm. We're going to be discussing more about the feeding part and the management more specifically. But when it comes to, again, the differences between these two conditions, I get the sense that the squamous gastric ulcers, they're more... It's easier to sort of determine, it's easier to see a straight sort of line between management and the actual issue. And when you then do something about the management and perhaps medicate to enhance or improve the environment in the stomach, then you will solve the problem. It's quite clear. But when it comes to the glandular ulcers, that it's not as clear what is actually causing them. And that makes it not as clear as what you're going to be doing about them. And we're also going to be talking a little bit about stress later and different examples of horses that fantastic stories that really shows that a horse can really be stressed out about things that we would never imagine. But I mean, also since the management changes and the feed advice that you give to owners when managing and the squamous gastric ulcers, I mean, they're never wrong, really. It's most of the time ad libitum feed, or at least a lot of food spread out throughout the day, and that's seldom wrong for any horse. So I guess the management advice could be similar. It's just more difficult to sort of nail down what exactly is it that's causing the glandular ulcers. But you were mentioning risk factors a little bit, and that there's different risk factors for different conditions. And you also did mention that, depending a little bit on the studies, different studies find different risk factors. But if we take the common ones, the ones that we're pretty sure about, what would you say are the most common risk factors for squamous and glandular, respectively? Yeah.
For the squamous part, I think the major risk factor that I have found is if the feeding management is not appropriate. So in my book, I would like to have the horses fit if they are okay with that. Of course, some horses are not. But the golden number is 1.5% of their body weight. They should be fed in roughage every day. And every horse is not the same. So it's very individual. But if you are going to remember one number, it's 1.5% of its body weight. So that means that per 100 kilo of horse, they should be offered at least 1.5 kilos of hay, as a rough rule. It's a little bit more, a little bit less, depending on the dry matter of your food, of course. But remember that single number. And that's very easy to talk to the owners about. Send them home, have them weigh their hay, because you might get surprised. The other thing is how is the horse offered this? Is it offered it in its stall, or is it offered as a group? And the owners never realize that horse is being chased away from the feed, and never, even though it's offered ad libitum roughage, it's never going to eat that because it's in a group that's bullied, that it's getting bullied. So there are a lot of things that you have to act as a little detective to get into that. I need to know if 1.5% roughage gets into the horse, wherever the road is from the horse is getting, or the owner is feeding it, to it gets inside the horse. That's the road that they need to evaluate. And there are a lot of steps that can go wrong about this. It could be palatability of the food that the horse is offered, but it's not eating it. And if you're in a straw box, they just walk around it, and it's completely impossible to judge whether the horse is eating it or not. So that is a very important piece of the puzzle for me, is the feeding management at home. That's probably the biggest one. Very often, if you correct that, you can see a dramatic change in ulcer grade, of course, with medical management as well. But that's the key. So that's the most important thing for me, risk factor-wise.
And the glandular ulcers.
Yeah. The glandular are a little bit different because, of course, we want to have all the roughage in as well. But we also want, we've seen a lot of risk factors getting proposed at the moment. Things like how long are the horses getting ridden per week. A fairly new study that we'll come back to had looked at the use of the horses per week. And if you had horses in training for more than, I think it was 180 minutes per week, and it sounds like it's about 5 to 6 to 7 days of active work through the week, that increased the risk of getting ulcers. If the horse was handled by more than, I think it was 3 people, more handlers, that could be an issue as well. And a big thing as well for both of them, I think, and I don't think we can differentiate that yet, is underlying disease, like other diseases in the horse, orthopedic disease, dental issues, all those things is probably in play likely with both of them, but we will know more about that for sure. So it's a little bit more vague, but it seems like it has something to do with the our use of the horse as well that could become a problem.
Yeah. So you mentioned the detective work, and of course it's always important, as we also concluded in the last episode, that you ask a lot of questions and that you don't just stick with one explanation or one clear symptom, but that you are really a detective here and ask a lot of around questions. So when it comes to diagnosing, and we have this golden standard, that is the gastroscope, just really shortly on, if someone out there, a vet out there is listening and never held a gastroscope in their hand, just really short, how do you go about, what are you sort of looking for? And
the key with a good gastroscopy is, of course, that the horse is fasted.
Yeah.
And we know that this big, healthy feed mass that we have there in the feed ball, it will take between 16 and 24 hours before that's completely emptied out of the stomach. So that's why in a normal horse, there's nothing that's called an empty stomach.
Yeah.
You have to fast them for this long before that feed ball is gone, and you can see as much of the mucosa as you want. And there's no way of telling which horse is going to be okay with fasting for 16 hours. Some will be empty around 12. Some will be empty at 36. But a good round number is anywhere between 16 and 18 hours. For me, I've never had a problem giving them water because they rarely drink when they are not eating. So that's a very important thing that I don't think it'll makes a difference that if you pull the water or not. But if you want to make sure you don't have them drink a lot just before, you take the water away a couple of hours before you're doing the scope. So you have to sedate the horses, and then you apply the, you have to have some good handlers as well. The horse needs to be fairly sedate, and then you insert the scope through the nostril, either straight through the nostril or via a tube. It depends on what scope you have, thick or thin. And then you advance it through through the esophagus and into the stomach. And then you have to have the stomach inflated with some air. So the stomach, as it gets more and more empty, it will contract. So once you get into the stomach, it will be contracted, and you have to insert air to expand just like a balloon. Mm. And then as it expands, you can start seeing the mucosa from the inside, the squamous part in the top and the glandular in the bottom. And there will always be gastric acid in there. There will be a pool of gastric acid in the bottom, combined with some bile reflux, which is also normal in horses that's fasted. But usually that wouldn't be a problem that you can dive into and get into the duodenum when you need that. And you start examining the stomach from the top and then slowly advance into the bottom. And in my opinion, horses can be extremely different to scope. So I've had horses that I could scope in 2 minutes, go straight in, see everything, dive into the soup, into the pylorus and into the duodenum. Done, no problem. I have also had horses where I've been standing for 45 minutes and it's almost impossible to get into the duodenum for some reason. So I think that's a very important lesson for all the new scopers, that sometimes you get that horse that's just much harder to maneuver around. And it's not necessarily because of your skills. It's just that's how it is. Mm. So don't give up. Just practice. And the next one you do, you'll probably do in 10 minutes and everything's good. Mm. I would say before you examine the mucosa, you need to flush the mucosa for old food because you do have some roughage sitting around. And to be able to evaluate it properly, it would be nice to have some flushing in place so you can flush the mucosa before you evaluate. And then you grate what you see. And before you extract your scope out, you suck out the air. Some of us have a pump, or you can suck out some air via a big syringe. But I think it's important to attempt to take some of that air out that you have inflated so it doesn't stand around with a big stomach, because that can cause some discomfort after the procedure. And then you just slowly take the scope out. And as you go out, you remember to examine the esophagus when you go out. Don't do it on your way in, but do it on your way out. Slowly extract your scope, evaluate the esophagus all the way up so you see that there's no problems there. And then your exam is over.
That's very good practical tips there, I think. So this is golden standard, and this is what you really need to do if you want to be 100% accurate of what you're having. But as you know, in our countries especially, maybe not every vet has a scope, and it might be very far to a clinic with a gastroscope. And there are also horses that just simply won't tolerate standing in a box or being fasted or whatever, even if most probably do. Then there is always an option, I guess, to diagnose without a scope. It's not recommended, but in reality, it's often being done. What are your thoughts on that?
We don't have any good diagnostics if we don't have the scope. There is no way you can say for sure. And maybe you can say that there is an effect of your medication. So that's called treatment diagnostics, that you add the anti-ulcer medication to the horse and send the horse home. The owner calls you back and say the horse is completely different. The problem is that you can't gauge how long are your treatment going to last for. And you don't know what's going on. How severe was the ulcers? Was there anything else that's causing the pain that's relieved by removing acid? So you're working in the dark. So the risk of recurrence when you stop your medication is quite high because you don't know how it's looking down there, whether it's very, very mild or whether it's bleeding and tumors or something else could be down there. Mm. And they will all act better at that time. So that's the problem with not actually coming down there and have a look at what you're dealing with. Now, it would be wonderful if we could diagnose ulcers on a blood test or a fecal sample or saliva, and all of those things have been studied. Blood tests are of no use at this point. There's nothing specific that could indicate that your horse has an ulcer, a gastric ulcer. Fecal samples, we've been looking for blood in the fecal samples, and there's pretty solid evidence for this now to not be accurate when it comes to ulcers. It has nothing, no sensitivity when it comes to this. Saliva is one of those that are a little bit interesting. As of now, there are some mild evidence that we in the future might get some results that could support this, but it's still very, very early. And there is a risk that it will be as the blood markers in the feces that was very promising at the beginning, but as time passed, it became insignificant and we can't use it. So it's very early on, but there are some studies supporting saliva diagnostics of various things. They're not commercial yet, so we can't say anything about them yet, but it's on the research state. And then again, the treatment diagnostics where you put them on the medication and evaluate the response to the medication is what I would always say to owners, that if we do have a proper response, then I would definitely recommend to scope the horses when we finish to make sure that we don't have anything else in there and that we're done with the treatment. Again, it's up to the owner whether they want it or not, but it is a very important piece of the information to have.
But that's interesting. So if you have an owner who say, so I have to travel 6 hours to get a gastroscopy, I can do it once, but I won't do it twice, then you would rather have it at the end of a treatment than in the beginning, or depending maybe on the situation?
I think that's the key, because when you put your horse on medication, the good thing about some of these medications are that it gives you a change in the horse's behavior quite quick. Mm. So with fairly limited risk of adverse effect events. So if I have one, I would rather be sure that I don't have anything left that I can stop the treatment than if I start it and then evaluate it. I don't know how long to treat it for. Sometimes I have to check the horse again after 4 weeks, and then I see that it still has ulcers. And then I have to continue And then I don't know how long to continue for. So I'd rather use my gastroscopies to evaluate the horse and hopefully be able to stop the treatment at that point and know that we're done with the disease process than working in the unknown. But it really, really puts you at risk for various misinterpretations if you're limited to the diagnostic-wise.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, it's really tricky.
Yeah.
Tricky one, especially for those who have a situation like that they would have to drive a long way.
Yes. But it's just we as vets, we cannot always predict how things are going to go, and that's why we have our diagnostic tests.
Yeah.
I mean, it is one of those things that if we're asked to limit our diagnostics, it would be the same as you have to take a guess based on what you have had. And it can be very difficult to work in the blind, which is essentially what we're going to do. So
definitely. Tack för att du lyssnade på Hästveterinärerna. Om du gillar det du hör, lämna gärna en recension i din podcast-app. Berätta gärna om podden också för dina vänner och kollegor. Eller dela den i sociala medier. Vi är snart tillbaka med ett nytt intressant avsnitt av Hästveterinärerna.